All right, if you take your seats, we'll continue on with our second speaker. So as you may have noticed, the second speaker we had originally planned was unable to make it, unfortunately, but we are extremely fortunate to have Dr. Ann Fausto-Sterling, who was willing at the last second to take her place and speak to us today. She is Professor Emerita of Biology and Gender Studies in the Department of Molecular and Cell Biology and Biochemistry at Brown University. She is the founder and former director of the Science and Technology Studies program there as well. She is the author of over 60 scholarly articles and several highly influential books, including Myths of Gender, Biological Theories About Women and Men, Sexing the Body, Gender Politics and the Construction of Sexuality, and most recently, Sex, Gender, Biology in a Social World. So Professor Fausto-Sterling will be speaking to us today on acquiring gender, from baby in the yellow hat to gender identity and expression. Please join me in welcoming Professor Fausto-Sterling.
So this is obviously a surprise to all concerned, including me. I was just planning to come up to listen to three of my younger colleagues talk about testosterone today, and I was just excited to hear them and to meet one of them for the first time since Cordelia lives in Australia and we've corresponded but haven't ever met in person. And then I hear that Rebecca Jordan Young is ill, and I have a canned talk and I was coming anyway, so here we are. So that being said, I will not be talking directly about testosterone. But I think that the approaches that I'm trying to develop to thinking about bodies as simultaneously material and socially constructed are completely compatible with what you've just heard from Sari. And in fact, she and I have had extensive email conversations about these matters in the last couple of years, which is just really great. So what I hope to do is not give you sort of firm answers, but rather try to shift how you might think about problems of gender identity and gender expression, and how you might think about studying the development of gender outside of this old framework of nature nurture, but more in the framework of sex gender. And the theories that I use, the main theory that I'm trying to develop in various ways is some version of dynamic systems theory, and I'll be weaving that into the talk. So this is what babies look like when they come into the world. They come in a sort of limited set of sizes, many different colors, kind of different kinds of shapes, and we dress them in different ways. And we can't, by looking at this picture, tell who's who in terms of who's a boy or who's a girl or who's going to grow up to be a homosexual or gender queer or whatever. And so the question is, how do these babies acquire identities? I'm going to say that they do not have identities when they are born. And so how do they acquire identities as gay or straight or gender queer or male or female or cis or trans, or butch presenting, or femme presenting. I mean, we can add to that list, and that list has been expanding in recent years. So for me, this is what I might call the identity challenge, which is to explain complete, complex people. And again, that's a theme that we've already heard in the previous talk. And to explain stable identities and behaviors, because these identities and behaviors that I've just spoken about are often extremely stable. They don't change from day to day, usually, or even from year to year. But sometimes they change. And so we also need to explain how behaviors and identities change. So we have to have simultaneously an explanation of stability and an explanation of instability in order to have a theory that really tells us much about whole complex people. So that's the challenge. And what I want to do today is give you a kind of conceptual toolbox to think about these matters. And the concepts that are on this list are straight out of developmental dynamics theory. And the first of these is emergence and development. I am a developmentalist. I was trained studying embryos of fruit flies and little flatworms that develop, and And now I'm studying little human people that develop. And what's so clear is that you have to me, is that to understand where something comes from, you have to start before it exists, and you have to watch it emerge over time. You have to watch it develop. The second is what the theorists call equifinality, and that's just a fancy way of saying many roads lead to Rome. So you have endpoints that we think of as real things. A person is gay, we say, but that doesn't mean there's only one way they became that way. There are many different paths that might lead to that. So you have the same end, but you have different ways of getting there. And so we have to understand what those possibilities are. The third point I want to make is that I am not talking about traits. I'm talking about processes, that our identities as male, as female, as gay, as straight, as all the other things on that list I showed you, are maintained through underlying processes. They are not fixed traits. And that means, and they may be very, and the underlying processes may interact together in a way that make these, that make the expression very stable. But the fact that they're ongoing maintenance processes means if they get disrupted, then if they reassemble, they may not reassemble into exactly the same conformation they were before. This is related to the notion of soft assembly. It's another way of thinking about this, which is that we are, in our behavioral systems, softly assembled. We are assembled, again, through a set of interlocking underlying processes that stay in place, but that assembly is not necessarily fixed. It's not, quote, I mean, you hear the phrase in neurobiology, hardwired, but it's assembled softly, and again, it can get disassembled for that same reason. So these point three and four are interrelated to one another. And then lastly, as I've already mentioned, we need to be talking about stability and instability. So I think we can think about this at different levels and using different kinds of rules. I've put on here at the bottom a developmental timeline, which is always in my head as we think about, which is part of what dynamic systems tells us about, and that for what I want to talk about in terms of infancy is that the levels that we can need to be thinking about are both neurobiological and psychoanalytic, and that the two of these together produce an embodied sense of identity, and that they are linked by memory. So memory becomes an extremely important thing to be thinking about in early infancy, at ages where most people don't think about memory. That is, and particularly in the first year of life, in a period where memory is spoken of as being pre-symbolic. That is, it's before language. It's in the nervous system. So for me, embodiment, to really understand embodiment, and then as it leads to an embodied sense of identity, we need to be thinking about all of these two things linked together. So first, let me tell you three things that I think are important about the neurobiological component. And the first of these is that the infant brain makes connections, and it makes it phenomenally. So this is a slice from the cerebral cortex of a newborn, and it shows a bunch of individual neurons. They're not very elaborated. They don't touch each other very much. They don't have connections to one another very much. At age 1 month, they're growing out little branches. They're not so much increasing in number as they are beginning to elaborate and make contact with one another. By 9 months, they've grown enormously, and they are in contact with one another. They become very bushy. They're making synapses and connections like crazy. At 2 years, it's a dense, tangled mass in the neural cortex, and in the adult, it's backed off a little bit. And that's because there are all sorts of tentative connections that are made by 2 years, and they aren't all maintained. So the neuroconnectionists say the neurons that fire together wire together. So there's a lot of interconnections made, and they aren't all maintained if they aren't reinforced. And I'll show you an example of that in a sec. So Point number one, the infant brain makes connections, and it makes it a lot, and it's after birth, but it's also starting to make it before birth, and that's an interesting point we can talk about. The second is that connections depend on patterns of experience, and particularly of sensory experience, that happens postnatally, primarily, although sound at least gets into the uterus, so there's neural connections having to do with the auditory system that's getting made prenatally. So you have learning, memory, and neurogenesis are experience and experience-dependent synapse formation. And this has a kind of frightful scale, but because the scale keeps changing, it goes from months to years to decades out here. But let's look here from birth to a year. And at some key things, we see that there's rapid synapse formation and
pruning of synapses later. But this is the period we're looking at, and also that there's a great deal of myelination going on. So myelination is part of the way in which nerve cells get insulated and begin to track electrical connections, and also it's probably a way in which nerve cells begin to limit interconnectivity with other cells. But the point is that we don't start out with a pre-made brain here, that these are going on as infants are being touched, as they're smelling, as they're seeing, as they're hearing, as they are absorbing the world through their sensory system. Now, if we look at, that's myelination, did that already? But if we look here, this green shows the degree of proliferation of the brain growth having to do with the audio and visual system. So it's growing enormously and very steeply in this first 3 months, and then the growth rate begins to level off. If we look at the blue, that's the language cortex, and that follows on a little bit later. And then the prefrontal cortex, which begins to grow, and as many of us are probably aware, has some interesting things going on in the teen years as well. So the brain is making connections, and it's making them postnatally, and it's making them in experience, and the connections that they're making are experience dependent. And the experiences that we are having are sensory experiences, and they are gendered experiences. At which I'll get to more. The third point here is that identity development starts in early infancy, and this is a claim I'm going to make. You can argue that I'm wrong about it, but I can argue that you need to do some experiments, and no one even thinks about this period. I could be wrong, but if we look at, I want particularly to look at this period of 0 to 1 years and what's going on. And we're looking at low sensitivity and high sensitivity of the nervous system to things that are going on in this period. The whatever color that is, the bright pink, is emotional control, which is developing enormously in this first year as infants are interacting dyadically with their caregivers, primarily. The green is habitual ways of responding, again, something that's really starting out and developing enormously in this first year. The red is the ability to perceive symbolic representations that are in their life, and that also is growing enormously in the first year, and then develops further and becomes and the infant becomes able to express that as language is acquired. And then language is going on. It's the sensitivity language is huge in the first year, but it remains quite high for quite a while. So those are three things to think about what's happening neurobiologically. If we think about memory, let's think about three things. In each case, I'm going to try and give you three things to think about. First is that young babies have really complex memories, and this is a claim made as a result of years and years of work by a psychologist named Carol Rovey Collier, who kind of exploded the field of infant memory you know, over 30 years ago now, because people used to, psychologists used to think that infants didn't have memory until they had language. And what she showed, and this is, I'll show you this, this is a little clip of a study she did on 3-month-old infants. And what she does is she tethers their little foot to a mobile. And at first the infant's moving at random and the mobile's moving whenever it moves. And then after a while, in a training session, the infant figures out that if it moves its foot, it gets the mobile as a reward. And then they can repeat the experiment a week later, 2 weeks later, and see whether the infant gets the motility going faster, in other words, whether the infant remembers. And the infant does remember, and I'll just show you the little clip. And the infant remembers other things as well. The infant remembers better if it's in the same context. Here, the context of the crib is covered with a kind of this checkered thing. The infant will also remember a connection between whether there's a special toy in the crib. So this is the infant's not seeing the Raggedy Ann doll here, but if they put the Raggedy Ann doll in when the infant is first learning, later, if they try the infant out and put the Raggedy Ann doll in, it'll start to move just as quickly, and it'll get just as excited by either being in the same context or by seeing the Raggedy Ann doll. And I also want you to watch for the student who appears in here briefly when I run this. Let's see if we can get this going. Yeah.
Now the cat kicks just as before for my
There, now Jesse's getting it. Yeah. Okay, so you get the idea, and if they do the, and this was that, I think you could tell that the video was, this was actually a 10-minute session, and you didn't want to watch this for 10 minutes, really. But the point is that if they give that same baby a trial on this in 2 weeks, it will not take 10 minutes to figure it out. It will do it in whatever, 3 or 4 or 5. And they can do these. And it turns out babies have memories that seem to work pretty much the same as adults, except that they're shorter. They don't retain for as long, but they retain better if they have the same experience over and over again. So repeated experiences are remembered better and for longer. So long-term infant memory associates objects and context. And I'm going to show you a couple of examples here from some videos that I've been studying and show you what some of the objects and contexts I think might be important are. These are things that we scored on a second-by-second basis, so these are very short interactions. I'll show you this one first. So, almost 20-week-old boy. And this is a snippet of Music Box and the mother is stroking the infant. Notice the baseball outfit. And the butt or the stuffed toy. So you have musical melody is playing in association with calm maternal stroking and face-to-face interactions. And that episode went on for about 3 minutes and I just took a snip of it from the tape. But also imagine that association if that's a repeated event in the way mother and infant interact at a certain moment. So you have a certain kind of affect, a certain kind of touch associated with the playing of soft music in that case. This one's a little different. It's also a boy. I don't think it matters so much for these that we're talking about a boy or a girl, except if these patterns look really different.
Big boy! Where you going, big boy? Where are you walking to? Where are you walking to? Yes! Get yourself!
The associations are high arousal, physical play, maternal affection, and I forgot to point this at you, but there was a truck in there, which was just passive presence. It's not unlike the little doll that was used in some of Rovi Collier's experiments in the crib. So it wasn't the main focus of attention, but it was in that moment of interaction in which the boy was getting called a big boy, he was getting motor experience, and he was getting a lot of affection and high positive maternal arousal. So that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about. And then the last point is that memory formation involves actual anatomical changes. And this is part of the point where I think those of us who are trying to view the world this way keep emphasizing, which is that there are real material effects in the body of different social events that go on. So if we look first here at this panel and what's called a naive synapse, we have a neurotransmitter being released to a dendrite as a result of a stimulation and action potential. And there are a few receptors, and it gets a little bit of a nervous response here. So a weak response. But if we look at a trained synapse, there are a couple things to notice. There's an increase in synaptic strength after the experience is repeated. There's a strong electrical response. There's more neurotransmitter being transmitted, so there's more of this stuff, these little red symbols. And there's more receptors, so that there are literally physically these cells have changed in response to repeated stimulation. And also, in some cases, you get a whole new synapse developing as a response. So this is the third thing about memory to keep in mind, that memory formation of the sort I illustrated at that affective level actually results in physical changes in the nervous system. So if we move along now to what I call empirical psychoanalysis, let me give you three things to think about here. I know for a lot of my science colleagues, it's kind of, if you say the word psychoanalysis, they freak out. But I think that actually we have to think about analysis as or analytical ways of thinking about self as part of what goes on. And empirical psychoanalysis comes out of disciples of Bowlby, the British analyst who sort of brought mother and affection back into the constellation of things we need to think about in terms of infant development. There's a whole group of empirical psychoanalysts who study dyadic interactions, one-on-one interactions, second by second, between usually mothers and infants in order to see how these different interactions lead to good attachment or less good attachment, and then how that down the line may lead to behavior that involves acting out or not acting out. So it's attachment theory, but it's experimental attachment theory. A lot of it observational, and some of the experimental attachment things make
give me the creeps, but that's another, we can talk about that another time. So
one of the things that these folks say is that infants develop pre-symbolic representations of self and other as a result of or through the mechanism of two-way interactions. They have pre-symbolic memory of dynamic interactions with their main caregiver, and each partner, that is the main caregiver, the adult and the infant, influences the other from moment to moment. And the infant learns to recognize and expect recurrent interactive patterns. The second point is that self and identity emerge from these recurrent patterns. So the different dimensions of self and identity that emerge are first the time dimension. So the infant stores the rate, rhythm, sequence, and contingency of two-way interactions. And I'll show you some videos again where you can see this, not the storing, but you can see what I'm talking about in terms of the interactions. The infant learns space dimension. So the infant stores patterns of approach or approach-approach or approach-avoid within a dyad. They learn how close faces come, how far apart they stay, when different facial expressions begin to have an effect. So they learn a space dimension. And the argument is that at first, there is not a separate infant. There is only a dyad. And that one of the tasks of the first year is to learn what it is to have a self. So to learn what the spatial separations are, to learn what the rates of and rhythms of interactions with others are. The facial affect dimension in the infant stores how faces move together in positive or negative looks and voice tone. And then associated arousal patterns. We already saw two arousal patterns in those videos. So the one mother was being very quiet and calm and stroking the infant, and that was a very low arousal pattern. And then a different play pattern with a different mother and a different setting. That mother was highly aroused. Again, these were both positive arousals. You can have negative arousal too, but these were both examples of positive arousal. And so the infant is learning what the associated arousal patterns are with these different interactions. And then the infant begins to develop proprioceptive experience of his or her own movements. So again, to begin with, infants don't understand where the infant leaves off and the caregiver begins, but they develop that sense of separation, of physical separation, of physical self-knowledge during this first year also. So dyads structure their interactions in several ways. The first is by state transformation, so the expectation and arousal state can be transformed via the action of a partner. So a baby is crying, the mother comes over and tries to smile at it or jiggle a toy in front of it, and the mother's expectation is that she or the caregiver's expectation is that the caregiver can change the state that the baby is in, that the infant is in, by a set of actions. And the infant also develops expectations that it can change a mother's or a caregiver's state of arousal by smiling or laughing or doing something funny. So one of the things that develops in this first year is the sense of state transformations. Oops. Some of this happens through facial mirroring, the expectation of matching or being matched in affective change. And this is thought by attachment theorists to enable empathy in the developing child. And then you have disruption and repair. And this is the expectation of how easy or fast interactive repair is after facial visual mismatches. And I'll show you an example of this. It'll be clear to you. So this is thought to organize expectations of for the infant of coping effectiveness and hope. And then lastly, you have interpersonal timing that helps structure this, and this is the expectation of the degree of vocal rhythm matching and also thought to enable empathy. So you have these subtle things going on in this first year, and especially even in the first months, that that help dyads structure their interactions. And I'll show you a couple of examples of these. Watch, especially in the beginning, you'll see a pattern, mutual gaze disrupt repair. And this is going on with vocalization and gross motor and muscle strengthening. So she's looking, he's looking, look, he looks away. And she's going to bend down to try and reconstruct that gaze, that connection, which she does. And that, he's probably looking at the camera person. But. And then she's going to she's reconnecting the gaze again. As this tape goes on, she not only works on arm strengthening, but then, and I don't show this, she starts doing the bicycle thing with the legs too. Okay, this pattern again continues for 3 minutes, adding in legs. And let's just show you this other video. This is what I call his ballet legs, you'll see why. And this is, the mother says this, you'll hear it. This is a manic mother. So she's also doing gross motor stimulation, but in a very different. So high arousal, motor work, vocally attached to ballet. So, and again, in a, how old was that infant? I forget. But anyway, it was not that old.
17.
How much?
17.
17 weeks. Okay. So, let's talk about the timing of things like of the kinds of events that I've been talking about, pre-symbolic learning, with what we. How are we doing on time?
You're doing very well.
Okay, good. All right. With because I am drawing it to a close. So with what's known about gender, and with what infants learn about gender. So, so prenatally to 12 months is the period that I'm talking about of pre-symbolic embodiment. So the infants are embodying things that they're encountering in the world, all of these dyadic interactions, they're embodying the, they are seeing and remembering the things that are around them, the toys in their crib, the truck near the head of the bassinet, those kinds of things. And these become, in the period from 12 to 24 months, linked to symbolic gender. So, so as by 24 months, and really even by 18 months, infants can passively identify in experiments, or toddlers then can passively identify gendered things, and they are linked to symbols. So, and the symbols are things like the color pink or the color blue or certain kinds of toys. And this you can show experimentally, that in this age period, infants link to can begin to identify symbolic gender. They can identify it also in adults. So there's one set of experiments in which I think 18-month-old infants are shown pictures of drawings of adults doing different things, and they show men doing doing manly things, you know, so traditionally manly things, and then in the midst of it, and the infant's looking and looking and looking, and then in the infant, in the middle of it, they stick in a picture of a man putting on lipstick, and the infant stops and stares. So they're recognizing gender, quote, inappropriate behaviors, and they do it also for drawings of women, showing them washing dishes, cooking dinner, and then they show a drawing of a woman with a work belt and a hammer hanging out of it. And again, the infant stops. The infant recognizes that's something out of the ordinary, even before language. So at first it's passive, but then it begins to show up more. So between 24 months and 5 years, gender identity in the infant certainly begins in the toddler and young child, certainly begins to appear, and we're very aware of this with all of the current stories of 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds announcing that they were born as a boy, but announcing that they think they're really a girl, and also when even so those become sensational pictures, but also in the cis situation, children begin in this age range from 24 months to 5 years to begin to develop and express a sense of self as male or female. And then these become strongly expressed as strongly held beliefs, I would say even pleasures, in particular kinds of clothing, color, toys, that children gravitate to. So whether it's girls who like to wear certain kinds of dresses or whatever. I mean, there are these famous pictures which I've shown elsewhere of an artist who's assembled. It's girls with their pink things and boys with their blue things. But these are this is symbolic gender. I mean, these are symbols of gender, and children develop very strongly held beliefs of how they should be dressed and how they should express themselves. And these are all interlinked. And so if you've put in a time scale, the pre-symbolic leads to symbolic normally. Gender identity and symbolic are certainly feed back on one another. As do these strongly expressed beliefs feed back and forth on gender identity. So one of the interesting questions to ask, I think, is what happens if this timing is off? So suppose pre-symbolic formation doesn't happen before symbolic formation begins. Suppose a child is neurologically a little bit different. Suppose there's a crisis in the family and the child isn't handled as often or as well as they might be in a more relaxed situation, so that their pre-symbolic formation is still going on at the time that they have access to language and they begin to develop symbolic possibilities. And so one possibility is for explaining or thinking about transgender is that these things become unlinked. These things become unlinked in this period, and it's a timing issue more than prenatal hormones, for example. So that's total hypothesis on my part, but by thinking about this in terms of a developmental timeline and thinking about the first year as being really important for pre-symbolic gender formation, you probably could find a way to begin to think to study this in a more systematic way. So things babies know about gender at 0 to 24 months. In the pre-symbolic period, 0 to 12 months, they can distinguish voices and faces of adults, male from female. Males and females have different matching patterns when they engage in dyadic play with infants, and they actually, it's a four-way thing. Fathers have different matching patterns for arousal and resolution of arousal, for example, in play. with daughters that differs from in their play with sons, and the same for mothers with daughters and sons. So there's at least a four-way set of possibilities. But they aren't the same for each parent. And I often get asked questions about same-sex parenting, and my guess is that they wouldn't be the same for each member of a same-sex couple either, but it's not. But the infants certainly understand that there are different behavior patterns or matching patterns from their male parents and their female parents. And probably this is also true that handling and touch is done differently by males and females in the lives of an infant, and that infants are aware of it. So the links to symbolic gender, which begin to show up at 12 to 24 months, the infants, as I just gave you the example, can recognize gendered behavior in adults. They begin the acquisition of gendered language, so they can know themselves as a girl or a boy. They begin to match toy play to language knowledge. So toy play follows on language knowledge. So as they have the words to say boy or girl, they begin to develop opinions about what kind of toy play belongs with those words. And then in the period of 24 months to 7 years, you get some other things going on, basically a consolidation of gender identity, which, and lots of other things affect these, the presence of siblings, the learning from peers, but they first you get the in 27 to 30 months, you get gender labeling of self and others. And then as the kids get older, they begin to believe that in something called gender constancy, that is that not only that they're a girl, but that they're always going to be a girl. That's the notion of constancy. And that ultimately becomes associated with genitalia, but that can happen. That's the last thing that come online, as it were. It can happen at as late as 7 years. And these different other things feed into them and are results of. So these are back and forths. So basically, you go from a passive notion of gender to an assertive notion of gender, to connected to symbols, to connected to genitalia, and with a gathering sense that gender is something permanent in self, in identity. So I want to tie this back to the ideas from dynamic systems, and I'll just show you a couple of quick little things. You can think of development then as if you think of each of these little balls as an infant, and this starting point here is birth, and they're born onto a landscape which is somewhat different. One place to another, and each little infant is different at birth too. And as development proceeds, they begin to roll down this landscape, and as they roll down, they are sort of bounced around on it into different places, depending on how the landscape develops. And they themselves are also changing the landscape. So in those dyadic interactions I was talking about, it's the caregiver and infant are trying to figure each other out. So the infant is trying to evoke a maternal behavior or a parental behavior. The parent is trying to get the infant to do something, and if the infant isn't doing what the parent wants, the parent tries something else. So the infant is shaping things. So if we watch these balls roll downhill, you begin to see they get trapped they go down into different places and into different valleys, and you can think of each of these valleys, say at 3 years, as being different, somewhat differently modified gender expression. I often use a more abstract notion of gender variance. So gender variant one, gender variant two, gender variant three, so that we don't get too stuck on labels. So if we go on to the conceptual tools that I introduced at the beginning, the first was that different or similar starting points. Genes, physiology, birth circumstances do not determine the outcome. So it's not a deterministic theory. And so you have this red ball here. This one, they both start at the same place, but they end up in different valleys. So they end up being different variations. The next point was this point about equifinality, which is different paths can lead to the same endpoint. The yellow ball starts in a different place than the red ball, but ends up in the same endpoint. but this one, the green one, ends up somewhere else. And then you have the soft assembly, which are states are stabilized by the depth of these valleys, which developmental dynamics people call attractor basins. And so you have they're in valleys and they're high walls or lower walls, as well as their own individual internal systems. So in one case, if it's a shallow valley, if I just backspace that again, you can see that it can get out of the valley and end up in a different valley. Maybe something happens that gets it activated into that other valley, but sometimes not. So here something happens, but it doesn't surmount getting over that wall. It just goes back into the valley it was in. So I'll end with a little video that's more fanciful, but showing the same thing. But watch, each of these kids is a little different at birth. This is the birth landscape. And watch because they move around as they develop. Oh, wait, back. Go. It's a little quiet kid and then a little crying kid. I mean, these are kids with different personalities at birth. Notice that the landscape's starting to become gendered. It's pink, that's blue. And that some of them have already changed places, but you still, at 3 months, you don't know where they're going. At 6 months, the landscape is bifurcating more. The pink is now pink and purple, and the blue is pink, purple, and at 12 months, this little girl is sort of more, has a different gender expression than this one. And by 18 months, you see this boy is the typical boy, he's got the truck and the baseball cap, and this one is a quieter boy with the teddy bear. This girl's rolling around in the mud and wearing her Oshkosh Bagosh, and this one's got her Barbie doll. And this kid hasn't figured it out yet. And I think this is an important point. This is an undergraduate did this video in conversation with me, and he said, well, let's not have them all get to the bottom at 18 months. Let's have some of them move at a different pace, and I think that's a really important point, which is this kid is sort of stuck behind this hill here and hasn't gone in any of these directions at this point, but is just developmentally at a little different time point, and it's not clear where he, she will end up. So let me close with that and hope that gives you a sense. And if you look back, you can see the mountains and valleys that these kids have passed through in these first 18 months of their life. So.